Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Phil Dierking and Pete Musto. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, workers at an Indian startup company are busy cutting up pieces of metal and using them to make unusual devices. Company officials say these devices will capture smoke from diesel generators and turn it into ink. Young engineers believe the technology will help to clean up the air in New Delhi, India's capital. Its air quality is among the dirtiest in the world. People often blame the millions of cars on the streets of New Delhi for the air pollution. But another big reason is the city's diesel generators. Industries and buildings use the huge machines to light up homes and offices during power outages. These outages often strike in the summer months. Arpit Dupar is one of three engineers who set up the startup company Chakar Innovation. He says that pollution from cars and other vehicles get all the media attention, but adds that the silent polluters are the diesel generators. Dupar decided to find a way to fight air pollution 3 years ago. At the time, he saw a wall blackened from the smoke coming from a diesel generator. This sight led to the creation of Chakar Innovation. Dupar had personally experienced the effect of the air pollution. He developed breathing problems while growing up in Delhi. As the dirty air becomes a serious health issue for many Indians, business leaders are looking at ways to improve air quality. Experts estimate that motor vehicles are responsible for 22% of particulate matter emissions in Delhi. Experts say that diesel generators are responsible for about 15% of those emissions. That air pollution travels deep into the lungs and can cause many kinds of breathing problems. After over 2 years of research and development, Chakar Innovation has begun selling devices to capture pollution from diesel engines. To date, the devices have been set up in 50 places, including private businesses. The technology involves cooling the air pollution in a heat exchanger where the dirty particles come together. These are then moved into another area that captures 70 to 90% of the particulate matter. The carbon is isolated from the emissions and turned into ink. One of the first businesses to work with Chakar was the law office of Jyoti Sagar. Sagar's daughter has long suffered from the harmful effects of Delhi's deadly air. He said the technology is very impactful, but is beautifully simple.
Let's be responsible and let's at least not leave behind a larger footprint, of carbon. And if we can afford to control it, why not? In the end, it's good for all of us.
In recent years, there has been a lot of talk about improving Delhi's air by reducing vehicular pollution and enacting stronger rules for vehicle manufacturers. But the same has not happened for diesel generators. There are efforts to punish businesses that dirty the air, but this often leads to them finding ways to get around the rules. Tushar Mater works at Chalker Innovation. He feels that turning smoke into ink is a useful solution. He calls the technology a win-win between businesses and the environment.
A new study shows that rising levels of planet warming gases may reduce important nutrients in food crops. Researchers studied the effects of one such gas, carbon dioxide, on rice. The researchers grew rice plants in a controlled environment. They set carbon dioxide levels to what scientists are predicting for our planet by the end of the century. They found that the resulting rice crops had lower than normal levels of vitamins, minerals, and protein. The researchers said the effects of planet warming gases would be most severe for the poorest citizens in some of the least developed countries. These people generally eat the most rice and have the least complex diets, they noted. A report on the study was published in the journal Science Advances. In the experiment, scientists grew 18 kinds of rice in fields in China and Japan. They pumped carbon dioxide gas over the plants in an effort to create the atmosphere of the future. Rice grown under high carbon dioxide conditions had, on average, 13 to 30% lower levels of 4 B vitamins and 10% less protein. The crops also had 8% less iron and 5% less zinc than rice grown under normal conditions. However, vitamin E levels increased by about 13% on average. The results are bad news, especially for the nutrition of the poorer population in less developed countries, said the University of Tokyo's Kazuhiko Kobayashi, who helped write the report. That includes about 600 million people in Indonesia, Cambodia, Myanmar, Bangladesh, Laos, and other nations, mainly in Southeast Asia, the report said. Other studies have shown that higher temperatures from climate change and weather extremes will reduce food production. But scientists are finding that rising levels of carbon dioxide and other planet-warming gases threaten food quality. Earlier studies showed that wheat, maize, rice, field peas, and soybeans grown under high carbon dioxide conditions all had lower levels of protein and minerals. Scientists estimated that almost 150 million people might be at risk of having too little protein or zinc in their diet by 2050. One of the scientists is Sam Myers of Harvard University, in the American state of Massachusetts. He said that findings like this are an example of the surprises climate change creates. My concern is there are many more surprises to come, he said. Myers noted that pollution, loss of some species, destruction of forests, and other human activities are likely to produce unexpected problems. He said that you cannot completely change all the natural systems that living organisms have grown to depend on over millions of years without having effects come back to affect our own health. The new study suggests a way to lower the nutritional harm of climate change. One way, Kobayashi said, is to grow different forms of rice that have shown to be more resistant to higher carbon dioxide levels. I'm Phil Dierking.
Astronomers have been closely watching an object that travels in an orbit around our sun. Astronomers say this object, an asteroid, circles the sun in the same orbital path as the planet Jupiter, but moves in the opposite direction. They say the asteroid came from somewhere else in the universe. And now, some experts believe it could be the oldest object in our solar system. In late May, researchers reported on a close examination of the asteroid and its orbit. They said that evidence suggests the asteroid formed elsewhere and was captured by gravitational forces when our solar system was formed. Their report was published in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society Letters. The researchers believe the sun, planets, and other objects in our solar system formed from a swirling cloud of gas and dust. They say this took place about 4.5 billion years ago. Fatih Namouni is an astronomer with the Observatoire de la Côte d'Azur in France. He was the lead writer of the report on the asteroid. Namouni told the Reuters news service that the asteroid is a strong candidate for the oldest object in the solar system. The asteroid has a long, somewhat complex name. It is called 2015-BZ509, or BZ for short. It is nearly 3 kilometers wide. Scientists say they are unsure about the materials it is made of. BZ travels in the opposite direction of all the planets and nearly everything else in our solar system. This kind of movement is called a retrograde orbit. How the asteroid came to move in this way, while sharing Jupiter's orbit, has until now been a mystery, Namouni explained. If 2015-BZ509 were a native of our system, it should have had the same original direction as all of the other planets and asteroids. BZ is not the first object that scientists recognize as having traveled from a different star system into our own. The first known alien traveler was a large object called Oumuamua. Researchers observed it passing through our solar system last year. But Namouni said BZ and Oumuamua are very different. Oumuamua simply passed through our solar system, while BZ has been orbiting the sun for a long time. Scientists have observed BZ with ground-based telescopes in the American states of Hawaii and Arizona. They said BZ apparently left its home star system when the star system interacted with other systems in a tight-fitting star cluster. The solar system formed in a star cluster where each star has its own planets and asteroids. The close proximity of the star systems, assisted by their gravitational interactions, helped remove and capture asteroids, Namuni said. Helena Moraes helped with the new research. Moraes is an astronomer at the Universidade Estadual Paulista in Brazil. She said the movement of BZ is similar to that of the planet Jupiter. They complete an orbit around the Sun in the same amount of time while moving in opposite directions, she said. BZ may be important in discussions about the development of life on Earth. This discovery tells us that the solar system is likely to be home to more extrasolar asteroids and comets captured early in its history. Some of these objects may have collided with the Earth in the past, possibly carrying water, biomolecules, or even organic material, Moraes added. The researchers said a number of other solar system objects with retrograde orbits are being investigated as possible alien asteroids. I'm Pete Musto.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. After the end of World War I, President Woodrow Wilson sought national support for his idea of a League of Nations. He took his appeal directly to the American people in the summer of 1919. Tony Riggs and Frank Oliver continue the story of Wilson's campaign.
The plan for the League of Nations was part of the peace treaty that ended World War I. By law, the United States Senate would have to vote on the treaty. President Wilson believed the Senate would have to approve it if the American people demanded it. So he went to the people for support. For almost a month, Wilson traveled across America. He stopped in many places to speak about the need for the League of Nations. He said the League was the only hope for world peace. It was the only way to prevent another world war. Wilson's health grew worse during the long journey across the country. He became increasingly weak and suffered from severe headaches. In Wichita, Kansas, he had a small stroke. A blood vessel burst inside his brain. He was forced to return to Washington.
For a few days, President Wilson's condition improved. Then, his wife found him lying unconscious on the floor of his bedroom in the White House. Wilson had lost all feeling in the left side of his body. He was near death. The president's advisors kept his condition secret from almost everyone. They told reporters only that Wilson was suffering from a nervous breakdown. For the next few days, the medical reports from the White House were always the same. They said Mr. Wilson's condition had not changed. People began to wonder, were they being told the truth? Some people began to believe that the president was, in fact, dead. Vice President Thomas Marshall was worried. If the president died or could not govern, then he, Marshall, would become president. But even Vice President Marshall could get no information from Wilson's doctors.
After several weeks, the president seemed to get a little stronger. he was still very weak. He could not work except to sign several bills. This simple act took most of his strength. Wilson's wife, Edith, guarded her husband closely. She alone decided who could see him. She alone decided what information he could receive. All letters and messages to Woodrow Wilson were given first to Edith Wilson. She decided if they were important enough for him to see. Most, she decided, were not. She also prevented members of the cabinet and other government officials from communicating with him directly. Mrs. Wilson's actions made many people suspect that she, not her husband, was governing the country. Some spoke of her as the nation's first woman president.
There was one issue Mrs. Wilson did discuss with her husband, the League of Nations. The Senate was completing debate on the Treaty of Versailles. That was the World War I peace agreement that contained Wilson's plan for the League. It seemed clear the Senate would reject the treaty. Too many senators feared the United States would lose some of its independence and freedom if it joined the League. The leader of Wilson's political party in the Senate, Gilbert Hitchcock, headed the administration campaign to win support for the treaty. He received Mrs. Wilson's permission to visit her husband. Hitchcock told the president the situation was hopeless. He said the Senate would not approve the treaty unless several changes were made to protect American independence. If the president accepted the changes, then the treaty might pass.
Wilson refused. He would accept no compromise. He said the treaty must be approved as written. Senator Hitchcock made one more attempt to get Wilson to reconsider. On the day the Senate planned to vote on the treaty, he went back to the White House. He told Mrs. Wilson that compromise offered the only hope for success. Mrs. Wilson went into the president's room while Hitchcock waited. She asked her husband, "Will you not accept the changes and get this thing settled?" He answered, "I cannot. Better 1,000 times to go down fighting than to surrender to dishonorable compromise."
The Senate voted. Hitchcock's fears proved correct. The treaty was defeated. The defeat ended Wilson's dream of American membership in the League of Nations. Mrs. Wilson gave the news to her husband. He was silent for a long time. Then he said, "I must get well." Woodrow Wilson was extremely sick, yet he was not the kind of man who accepted opposition or defeat easily. From his sickbed, he wrote a letter to the other members of the Democratic Party. He urged them to continue debate on the League of Nations. He said a majority of Americans wanted the treaty approved. Wilson probably was correct about this. Most Americans did approve of membership in the League of Nations. But they also wanted to be sure membership would not restrict American independence.
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee agreed to reopen discussion on the treaty. It searched yet again for a compromise. It made new efforts to get Wilson to accept some changes. But, as before, Wilson refused. He was a proud man, and he thought many of the senators were evil men trying to destroy his plan for international peace. Wilson's unwillingness to compromise helped kill the treaty once and for all. The Senate finally voted again, and the treaty was defeated by 7 votes. The treaty was dead. The United States would never enter the League of Nations. And one of the most emotional and personal stories in the making of the American nation had ended.
The long battle over the Treaty of Versailles ended with political defeat for Woodrow Wilson. Yet, history would prove him correct. Wilson had warned time and again during the debate that a terrible war would result if the world did not come together to protect the peace. 20 years later, war came. The First World War had been called the War to End All Wars, but it was not, and the Second World War would be far more destructive than the first.
The debate over the Treaty of Versailles was the central issue in American politics during the end of Woodrow Wilson's administration. It also played a major part in the presidential election of 1920. Wilson himself could not be a candidate again. He was much too sick. So the Democratic Party nominated a former governor of Ohio, James Cox. Cox shared Wilson's opinion that the United States should join the League of Nations. He campaigned actively for American membership. The Republican Party chose Senator Warren Harding as its candidate for president. Harding campaigned by promising a return to what he called normal times. He said it was time for America to stop arguing about international events and start thinking about itself again.
The two presidential candidates gave the American people a clear choice in the election of 1920. On one side was Democrat James Cox. He represented the dream of Woodrow Wilson. In this dream, the world would be at peace, and America would be a world leader that would fight for the freedom and human rights of people everywhere. On the other side was Republican Warren Harding. He represented an inward-looking America. It was an America that felt it had sacrificed enough for other people. Now it would deal with its own problems. Warren Harding won the election.
The results of the election shocked and hurt Woodrow Wilson. He could not understand why the people had turned from him and his dream of international unity and peace. But the fact was that America was entering a new period in its history. For a long time, it would turn its energy away from the world beyond its borders.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.